We reference it so often that we assume everybody knows the details, and that's a wrong assumption to make. And also, we reference it so often that maybe we become indifferent, callous to what really happened because of how familiar it is, and that's a mistake. It's the apex of the biblical narrative. Everything before it really points to it, and everything after it reflects back upon it. It's also the apex of human history. And when it comes to the life of Jesus, the death of Jesus is the main thing. Jesus did so many incredible things, and so many incredible things happened to him. But the weight of the biblical record shows that his death was of the utmost importance. And if we wish to see Jesus, as difficult as it is to do so, we've got to really look at his death. We've got to see the dying Jesus. We appreciate Zachary's songs because they do quickly review what we did last week and bring us to this point. The righteous, rather the religious leaders in their fake righteousness, wanted to silence Jesus. The Roman governor wanted to be free of the complicated situation of Jesus. And the crowd of people in Jerusalem who had been manipulated and misled by the religious leaders to now conclude that he was a fraud Messiah, they wanted Jesus crucified. Crux is the Latin term for cross. And to be crucified meant to be executed on wooden beams. And we have the New Testament information, though in a way it's quite scant, but we have a lot of historical information left by the Romans about crucifixion. There were actually three crosses that were used. One was a cross like a capital T, where the cross beam was set on top. Another one, which is more popular in, quote, Christian art, which basically you need to be suspicious of most of it because it's not accurate, is the cross beam is situated like a lowercase t, and also an X cross was used at times. It's hard to know for sure with Jesus. It appears, based upon some of the information, that it was the lowercase kind of t. But one thing that was required of the executee was that he had to carry the cross beam to the location. And by the time, early on what we would call Friday morning, that crossbeam was laid on Jesus, he was physically spent. We understand the emotional strain that is demonstrated that he's experiencing in the garden, fully experiencing the range of human emotions and facing what he was about to face. He had been up all night long. He had been attacked over and over and over by his accusers. He had been slapped. He had been punched. And then, just really a short time before that crossbeam was put on his back, he had been scourged or flogged, which was a beating which took the person to the threshold of death. And they led Jesus to the place that the Romans were using at this point for execution. It was called Golgotha, which means place of the skull. And the Latin term for skull is like the term that we have in English, Calvary. But it was really a place outside the walls of Jerusalem that most likely was not any more elevated than any other place around Jerusalem. All of Jerusalem is on hills. So there's hills everywhere. And it was some kind of probably bald spot, rounded spot near the entrance to Jerusalem, because the Romans were using this practice to deter criminals and insurrectionists. That's where Golgotha was. Outside of the walls of Jerusalem, but a very public place. And as they exit the city, Jesus collapsed. It's not indicative of a man who was physically weak. It was indicative of a man whose body could not really take much more. And so the Romans could do this. They could compel someone in their empire to do certain physical acts, even for the army, and they compelled a man by the name of Simon, who was from North Africa, a place called Cyrene. And he carried the cross the rest of the way, which probably enabled something to happen. We know that the crowd turned on Jesus and called for his execution, but also we're told that there was a crowd following him, mourning after him. And even though some of them may have also now rejected him as the Messiah, it was still occasion for mourning. And Jesus pauses and speaks to them, and especially the women. And he tells them, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves." And he said that a day was coming when people will wish that rocks and mountains would fall on them. And he references something. He said, if you do this in the green, what will you do in the dry? In other words, you're weeping right now, but a time for weeping really has not come upon you like it's going to come. This is most likely a reference to what Jesus describes in Matthew chapter 24, and that is the destruction of Jerusalem, the hand of the Romans, which would be a few decades later. Some of these people would still be living. And it would come because of, well, they'd rejected the Lord's Messiah. But now was the time for Jesus to suffer. And he's saying to them, don't cry for me. He's getting them to see what's going to happen. He's warning them, even showing at this moment care for them. When we're told in the biblical record that they crucified him, the biblical record does not elaborate except for just as it's telling the story what side information is necessary. It doesn't elaborate, it doesn't explain what crucifixion is. Didn't have to in the first century. And this is not a parallel, but it's like us saying, yeah, so-and-so had his appendix removed the other day. Just like that. Well, what's involved in removing an appendix? There's a lot. There's a surgery prep. There's the, you know, putting someone under. There's a lot involved. We know what that means. Nobody has to spell it out. Crucifixion. It appears to have started with the Persians, picked up by the Carthaginians, with whom the Romans had had many wars. They were located in North Africa. Then the Romans picked it up and they perfected it like they did a lot of things. It was used for non-citizens. That's why Paul was not executed by crucifixion. It was used on slaves. It was used for capital offenses, very high crimes, and it was used for crimes against the state, like insurrection. In other words, in essence, what Rome was saying to the public was, don't cross Rome or we'll put you on a cross. And it was not just execution, like other forms of execution, hanging, beheading, firing squad, electric chair, lethal injections, which all happened really fast. This was meant to be death by torture. Have you ever heard the term excruciating? The root of that word, crux, is the Latin word for cross. And what that word means, excruciating, is out of the cross. It's not a word I use a lot, but I think after looking at that this week, past week, I don't think I'll ever use that word again to describe something that I experience. And this is what would happen. The person was taken to the site where the upright beam was already there. And the cross beam was laid against the upright beam, sometimes notched, sometimes strapped. And then the executee was laid down on the cross beam and on the up beam. There is evidence that sometimes that their arms were wrapped in rope and they were strapped to the cross beam before the nailing took place. And actually, the last few decades have aided our understanding of crucifixion because they've actually uncovered some executees in some cases where the nails were still in their bodies. They were like not nails like you and I use nails. They were rough-hewn spikes. And they were probably something like that in length. And they would drive a nail on each side of the wrist area. It does talk about hands in the New Testament, but that term can also describe the lower arm. Because if the nail is driven into the hands, it usually rips out. But you can catch between the two arm bones, the wrist, and it will secure. And so the spike was driven into each wrist. The lower part of the body was twisted with the knees together, and one spike was driven through the ankles into the upright beam. There's also evidence that occasionally, or sometimes, they would put a little wooden block on the upright beam on the backside, like a very small seat. And it was not to make it more bearable. It was so that occasionally the person could put their weight on it and it would prolong the ordeal. It would give them just enough relief to keep it going. Because this is what would happen. The physical experience included obvious pain through the wrists and the ankles, the damage to the tendons and the nerves, and even the bones as they hung there. And even as horrific as that sounds, being nailed in the wrists and the ankles, that's not what killed you. There was significant blood loss from that. But we know that Jesus has already lost a lot of blood from the scourging. A lot of blood. And what would happen to a person as they hung there is that the blood loss, and Jesus's was accelerated, they would begin to dehydrate. And then with the dehydration and the stretching out of the arms and the legs, they would have wave after wave of muscle cramps. You know what that's like. And then there is Jesus in particular. His back is just ribbons of flesh from the scourging. That certainly instinctively he would try to keep off of that beam, but occasionally he couldn't help but for it to scrape that beam. And that flesh being torn again. There's just what Jesus was experiencing. There was no way for his blood to clot at those wounds that kept being open. His blood kept draining from him. He kept shedding his blood. The real problem in crucifixion to the flesh is that with being stretched out and the hanging points on the nails, it put incredible pressure on the chest area, the torso, especially the upper torso, and thus it compromised the respiratory system. And a person had trouble getting a breath. And to get a decent breath, they would have to pull up on those nails just to get a breath of air. But that would send so much pain in the ankles and the wrists that they would fall back down. And so there was this struggle up and down, up and down. And that lack of breathing deprived the body of oxygen, which then began to affect the organs and especially create fluid in the chest area and around the heart. And so his heart began to drown. This would go on for hours. In some cases with crucifixion, days. 3, 4 days. And on a rare occasion, even longer. That's crucifixion. We should get not too hung up on the references to hours in the crucifixion account. We forget this. But modern clocks like we have, they didn't have those in ancient times. They didn't have those until the 19th century. People calculated by hours and minutes to the exactness that we do. And so the idea of hours, third hour, sixth hour, ninth hour, it's just an estimation. Have you been somewhere without a watch or a clock? And you sort of guess what time it is? You know, it's mid-afternoon or late evening or early morning. Really, that's what those hours are intended to say. And it was about mid-morning, probably somewhere 9 to 11 o'clock, when Jesus was put on the cross. Wealthy people oftentimes sponsor charities. It's always been the case. There was a very interesting charity that was in Jerusalem at the time. Wealthy Jewish women contributed to a fund where they took wine, usually fermented wine, and they mixed it with a concoction of herbs and so forth that served as an anesthetic. And since the vast majority of people being crucified outside of Jerusalem were Jewish, some of them were criminals, some were insurrectionists, of which some Jewish people would be sympathetic to them. But just to show mercy, even to the condemned, a group of wealthy Jewish women had a fund where they purchased this anesthetic that would be offered to the executee. And this wine mixed with gall was offered to Jesus, and he did not drink it. Not one bit of numbing medicines. Not anything was done to lessen the experience of crucifixion. And even though he had to pull up on the nails to get a breath and to speak, and that's why you have these short statements of Jesus on the cross, the first thing that we can calculate that he says is, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Was this to the Roman soldiers? Was this to the Jewish leaders that had condemned him? Was this to the crowd that had called for his death? Guess for everybody. And probably everybody. And when Jesus was crucified, which was a common practice, because this was meant to be a deterrent to crime, the person walking to the execution site would carry around their neck a sign with their offense written on it. And oftentimes that sign would be placed somewhere on the cross. And for Jesus, there was put a sign that said, in three languages, in Greek, Latin, and Aramaic, the language spoken locally, "The King of the Jews." Once again, the chief priests, led by the high priest, probably Caiaphas, partners with the Pharisees, their typical opponent, and they go to Pilate and complain. You should put on his sign that he said he was the king of the Jews. Pilate had had it up to here with them. And this is one occasion where he knew he could resist them, and he said, "What I've written, I've written." So Jesus hung there with the sign of his offense, the king of the Jews. We are so used to clothing being relatively, okay, it is, they're cheap. Because of industrialization in the early 19th century, we can make cloth quick and easy and cheap. In ancient times, clothing was a valuable possession. Even people with decent means didn't have a bunch of clothing. It was harder to come by, harder to make, more expensive, took more skill. And most people had two garments. They had the inner tunic, which usually slipped over the head, and then they had the outer garment, sort of like a robe. And it says something about not only the valuable nature of cloth, but also the pay of the Roman soldiers. That as a bonus to the Roman soldiers carrying out this execution, they would claim the clothing of the victim or the executee. The outer garment had seams, and so they divided it in four parts. The inner garment did not have a seam, and to tear it would ruin it. So they cast lots, which is sort of like a roll of the dice, something like that, to see who would win it. 1,000 years before Jesus, in Psalm 22, we see David writing in first person about personal suffering. But it's clear you don't have to get very far into Psalm 22 and you see that David's not talking about himself. He's prophesying about the Messiah. And even down to that detail, Psalm 22 says that they divided his garments and for his clothing they cast lots. Okay, which is it? Did they divide them up or did they cast lots? It's both, because there were two garments. That specificity, just that detail there, 1,000 years before, and it's one of many details that describes the state of Jesus and what was happening to him on that day, 1,000 years before. But was Jesus completely without clothing on the cross? We have some evidence from the first century that says that people were executed on the cross naked, but we also have some incidents where a loincloth was put around them. And that term we encountered a few weeks ago. That Latin term from which we get our word linen, it's translated in John 13, Jesus put a towel around his waist. Do you remember when Jesus got in John 13 on his knees and washed the disciples' feet? That he took out his outer robe and he took a towel and wrapped it around his waist, which people did when they were about to perform some kind of physical, manual task. And Jesus wraps himself with a linen or a towel and gets down on his knees. If Jesus has anything on, once again, he's got a linen on. The attire of a servant. As if this was not enough. But for these evil people surrounding him that day, it wasn't enough. The Gospels record how that there are three sources, three rounds of people mocking him. First of all, there are the passers-by. Now, some artwork shows the cross way high. They were not that high. They were elevated, and the person's face is way beyond reach, and probably maybe their feet about waist high or chest high to you. But they were up a little bit. They were lifted up, as Jesus said he would be. And the passers-by said,
Ha!
Like that.
Ha!
You can look up the word in Greek. It means yes, like that. Like we, you know, it's a taunting thing. See, I told you so.
Aha!
They said. You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross. Remember, this is one of the accusations during the false testimony against him at the trial before Caiaphas the night before, when they misrepresented his words. Destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll rebuild it. He didn't say he would destroy the temple, the physical Herodian temple. But if you did it, he would. But he really, it was a double meaning. What he said was, destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll rebuild it. The Gospel of John says he's really talking about his body. These people were talking about the temple. And they say, if you've got that kind of power, then save yourself. Come down off that cross. They're taunting him. You see, this is the kind of people that a week before thought he was the Messiah and welcomed him as the Messiah. And now they've turned on him. And they almost feel betrayed here because they're rubbing it in his face. You're so powerful. You're so great. Save yourself. And then, no shock, there were the chief priests and the scribes, again, partnering together. Usually they were at each other like dogs and cats. And what they say? They don't address their mocking to Jesus. They say, speaking of him, he saved others. He cannot save himself. Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross, that we may see and believe. You see, all along, these religious leaders had called him a fake, and they tried to convince other people he was a fake, and they were able in the end to convince a lot of people and have them reject him as the Messiah. And what they're still trying to do is tell everybody else, he is not who he said he was. And right there he hangs and proves it once and for all. He cannot save himself. There's no way he's the king. We've already seen Roman soldiers mocking Jesus after the flogging. And they chime in. And the Roman soldiers, maybe reflecting a little bit of disdain for the Jews, which the Romans had, they say, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. What do they all have in common? The passersby, the religious leaders, and the Romans. They're taunting and mocking Jesus, and they're challenging him to save himself. He could have. He could have stopped this at any moment. He could have wreaked vengeance upon them. But if he saved himself by coming off the cross, he couldn't save us. And he couldn't save them. And so he hung there. But there are some others that Jesus has verbal interaction with in this first phase of the cross, which lasts probably about 3 hours. Being crucified, solicited, typically, two things from the executees. One, pitiful cries, moaning and groaning and crying and begging for mercy and relief. And the other thing it solicited, we have this verified by some great Roman historians, is that they would go on vicious rants. And in their pain, they would just be attacking everybody and anybody around them. They would call people names. Anybody got near them, they would spit at them. That's the only thing they could do. Jesus didn't do any of that. He maintained that silence, which had been so characteristic of him in the last 24 hours, reflecting this perfectly controlled power and this unspoiled holiness. He would never do that. We were told in the gospel records that two thieves were crucified with him. They had other business that day, the Romans did. And on either side of him were thieves being crucified, which meant that somehow their crimes were more than just grabbing a handful of this and that. They had somehow become an enemy to the state in this kind of criminal activity, and they were doing away with them once and for all. And in the early hours, both of these criminals attacked Jesus verbally. "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." Jesus was widely known. People had heard about his teaching and his miracles. Some had seen miracles. There was all this brouhaha in Jerusalem in that last week. Is he the Christ or not? It had been brewing a long time. And so they taunt him, "Are you not the Christ? That's who you're supposed to be. Then save yourself and us." But the ranting of one of the thieves melted away and was replaced with a completely different spirit. As the other thief continued to attack Jesus, one of the thieves rebuked him. "Do you not fear God? Since you are under the same sentence of condemnation." And he admits that we're suffering justly. We're guilty. But he says of Jesus, "This man has done nothing wrong." How did he know that? How did he sense that? Was it because of all that he'd heard about Jesus or things he'd seen in Jesus or just how Jesus was being treated and how he... We don't know. We do know this. He had done nothing wrong. And the thief was right in his conclusion. And in one of the most bold acts of faith among all the people that Jesus encountered on the earth, when Jesus is hanging there, condemned, facing death, completely defeated, this man turned to Jesus. And he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." He believes he's the Messiah. And pulling up to get a breath, Jesus answers him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." And there were others present there, besides the passersby, the religious leaders, and the soldiers who mocked him. There were disciples around the cross. And from the record, they were all female but one. There was Mary Magdalene, the mother of the sons of Zebedee, was there. Mary, the mother of James, the less, one of the other apostles. Salome, did I say her? One of the few non-Marys. Because among those disciples also was Mary, the mother of Jesus. We understand it's a very unusual relationship that this mother had with this son. But it was still a mother and son relationship. She was there seeing it. And then there was a male disciple. And when we run the references in the Gospel of John, the evidence points to John. Now Jesus said as they made their way to the Mount of Olives the night before that all of you will be scattered. And they all were. But John trickled back to Jesus. And he's in the courtyard when Peter trickles back to Jesus and gets him in. And now, he and among the apostles, John alone is at the cross. Jesus had brothers. The absence of references to Joseph in his adulthood indicates Joseph was no longer around, probably had died. But even though he has brothers who later on become believers, he entrusts Mary's care to John, his beloved friend. And he said to Mary, "Woman, behold your son." And to John, he says, "Behold your mother." And she went and lived with him starting that day. And then there is a shift in the scene. This is, by this point, midday in spring in Jerusalem, with passersby mocking, religious leaders mocking, the soldiers mocking, the criminals railing against him, the disciples standing and witnessing this. And then it went dark. In the middle of the day, the sun's light failed, and there was darkness over all the land. Why? So people say, well, God just couldn't look at this. Well, God doesn't need sunlight to see anything. But remember what Jesus said when they arrested him in the garden? Right as they were about to take him, he said, "But this is your hour in the power of darkness." The last few hours of the cross were in total darkness. And in the text, what you see there is that all the mockings and the railings and the picking at Jesus went silent. Because what would happen if in the middle of the day it all of a sudden went dark? That would be very disturbing to people. And that would be like, well, what has happened? What is going on here? And this went on from about the middle of the day until about mid to late afternoon that it was dark. And finally, echoing through that darkness came the words, "Eloi, Eloi, la sabachthani," which is translated, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Those are the opening words to Psalm 22. Jesus, in his physical state, could only utter brief statements, but he uttered the statement that pointed all of us back to that thousand-year-old prophecy about the suffering of David's son, the Messiah. What do we make of that? The Father forsaking the Son? What do we make of that? There's so many things that happen with Jesus, so many things that he says, so many things that are said about him, that we struggle with those things. And we're tempted to want to go through some gymnastics to say, well, really, that's not what it says. We want to come up with, well, it's not really that way. That's not really what he said. And that's a mistake. That just sort of needs to hit us and set on us. That Jesus is expressing what he's feeling. Forsaken. And I would have you see the other passages in the New Testament that best explain that. Are passages like 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, that says, "For our sake, he," speaking of the Father, "made him," Jesus, "he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." Jesus was pure and innocent and sinless. But how was he being treated? What was he experiencing? What had all the powers of the earth said about him? He's condemned as a sinner. And he's bearing the suffering of a sinner. But it's not his sins. Here was the real burden of the cross. Here was the real burden of all of Jesus' sufferings. It's not the physical. You know, there were two other people going through this crucifixion with him. This is not unique that he's suffering physically. People do that. And there are other people who have experienced being, you know, attacked by others, misrepresented, etc. Other people have experienced betrayals. But here's the real burden. Jesus had done nothing wrong, never had. He had never sinned. But he was receiving the punishment and the treatment as if he was the nastiest, vilest sinner ever to walk the earth. In that, he was forsaken as a sinner. You see, Jesus was not a robot. He had a will. We saw that in the garden. And he chose to submit to this, and he chose to be condemned, and he chose to be punished. He chose to hang between heaven and earth, to be suspended between God and sinful humans, and to be the representative before God of all sinful humanity and bear our sin before the Father. That's best I can do with that. And only the perfect Lamb of God to do that. Only the perfect Lamb of God could pay for all of our sins, and he did it. That's why he couldn't save himself, because he was trying to save us. But when Jesus said, Eloi, Eloi, in that darkness, some people thought he was calling for Elijah. Malachi chapter 4, which in our English Bibles is the last part of the Old Testament, some of the last lines of the Old Testament. Malachi 4 said that Elijah will come before the great day of the Lord. And the Jewish scholars legitimately had interpreted that as messianic, that Elijah will come before the Messiah. Well, in truth, Elijah had come. One like Elijah, John the Baptist. But when they heard him saying Eloi, some thought, he's calling for Elijah. He's calling for Elijah. Let's see if Elijah will save him. What is that showing there? As they stood in the darkness and heard this, even at that late hour, they're wondering, is he the Christ? Because they're wondering, is Elijah going to show up maybe on a bolt of lightning? Because you know how Elijah went to heaven, right? On a fiery chariot. He's going to come back down, rescue Jesus from the cross. Christ will emerge and conquer. Maybe Elijah will come down. But he doesn't. Stayed dark. And instead of some kind of victory shout, Jesus said one of the most human things he could say on the cross. I thirst. Of all the pain he'd experienced, of all the physical discomfort, of the slapping and the punching and the whipping and the nailing and the strain of hanging from that cross, we want it at 70 degrees and it gets 69 in the house and we're like, I'm freezing. We're 30 minutes past our lunchtime. I'm starving. I was in the garage yesterday and I rose up and I hit the corner of something metal. And it's still a little sore. And I'm like, ugh, and it hurt. And what really upset me is Lori wasn't there and I couldn't complain to somebody. What characterized Jesus from Gethsemane to the cross, though he does talk at times, what characterized him was silence. And the only thing he says about his physical condition is in these last, really probably moments, is, I thirst. And someone took a sponge and took the sour wine, a vinegar-like substance that the Roman soldiers would drink, and put it to his lips for some kind of tiny relief. And then came the end. All this wretched filth, this cruel injustice, this putrid vileness that had been vomited out of the worst of humanity over the last 24 hours, that was vomited out of human arrogance and pride and envy and selfishness and rebellion, all of this had been poured on Jesus. And he said, it's finished. His sacrifice on the cross was now finished. He's approaching the very end. His earthly ministry was finished. His earthly life was finished. But way more than that, this was the plan of God. And what God started in the garden when humans sinned against Him, to develop a way for them to come back. And everything you read about from Genesis 3 to the Gospels, it finally is all finished. The plan of God to save humanity through His Son. And Jesus says one more thing. Father, into Your hands I commit My spirit. When Jesus cried out, Father, why have You forsaken Me? He hadn't lost confidence in the Father. He was just expressing how he felt. Much like Job, who struggled and suffered but never gave up his faith. And here in his last breaths, what he utters is trust in the Father. You see, the physical experience took its toll. The trauma now was bringing the end. The nails into his wrist and his ankle that created so much pain and slow blood loss, the dehydration that set in, the muscle strain, the shock, the literal shock. We talk about people going into shock. Jesus experienced it. A lot of what he had been through. And the pressure on the chest cavity that compromised his breathing and filled his chest with fluid and surrounded his heart with fluid. And that had resulted in just a trickle of oxygen into his bloodstream, and his systems were just shutting down. Jesus was subjecting himself to every bit of that. This is not a mirage. He's experiencing every bit of this. And while he's experiencing it, he still knew when his last breaths were. And now this cup of suffering, the last drop, came out. And as he entrusted himself to the Father, he died. His spirit departed from that body. that tent he'd been in for 30-some years. That body he left, the body where God had dwelt among men. And the Son departed. This body, this earth, and that terrible, brutal place called Golgotha. The Son no longer was there. Merely that tent hanging without life. But such a departure would not be without signs. Just as there were signs at his birth. When Jesus died, the veil of the temple that separated the holy place from the most holy place was torn from top to bottom. What does that mean? Read the book of Hebrews. The earth quaked. Tombs were open. And yes, some of God's people resurrected and appeared in the city. And with all of his attackers, mockers, and even disciples, as they left the scene, beating their breasts, there was one voice heard. The Roman centurion. The man who was in command of the unit that executed Jesus. And he said, "Truly, this was an innocent man." And he said, "Truly, this was the," or "a," "Son of God." How did he know? That's not as important as what he said at that moment. Because this was the day before the Sabbath, and the Romans were sensitive to certain Jewish practices. They would not allow people to remain on the cross dying during the Sabbath. And so the soldiers came around as their practice, and they broke the legs of the two thieves, which then would make it impossible for them to pull up and get a breath, and then it would hasten the suffocation. When they came to Jesus, he was already dead. This is no sign of weakness. The man was half dead when he arrived at Golgotha. But the Romans were experts in execution. And before they could turn a body over to family, they had to make sure that the person was dead. And so a soldier rammed a spear into the side of Jesus. And out flowed blood and water. That chest cavity and that heart cavity was just drowned in blood and water. He was dead. But in that, Jesus remained the perfect Passover lamb, because Exodus 12 required that of the Passover lamb, not a bone would be broken. And Zechariah had prophesied in the 14th chapter in the 10th verse, "They will look upon him whom they pierced." The family didn't come. The apostles didn't come. But somebody did claim the body. His name was Joseph. He was from Arimathea, a nearby community. And he was a wealthy man who actually had a seat on the Sanhedrin council that had condemned Jesus to death. However, he had not consented to their condemnation. And actually, looking for the kingdom of God, he had been a secret believer in Jesus as the Christ. Secretly. But now he reveals the secret. And it shows that he was a man of some standing because he actually personally made a request of Pilate, the governor, for the body. And Pilate, first of all, checked, is he dead already? He verified it. If you're a Roman soldier, you're going to make sure that man's dead. And they verified that he was. And Pilate released the body to Joseph. He may have been accompanied by servants because of the handling of a dead body and all that would be involved. But we know for sure also that he was accompanied by someone. Nicodemus, who came to Jesus by night. And though Nicodemus, here he was, as a representative of the rabbi class, and Joseph was a representative of the Sadducee class, we have two lone believers from the two groups that called for Jesus' death. What a chore it was to take this body, and this is what they would do according to Jewish ritual in almost every ancient society. They would wash this body so encrusted with blood and fluid, so covered with pain, suffering. And then they would wrap it with linen. And then, because they did not embalm, they would cover the body with substances that would cover up the smell as the body decayed. They cover him with spices and ointments. Matter of fact, one of the ones they use, aloes, and the other one they use was myrrh. And as Joseph and Nicodemus and maybe some other servants care for the body of Jesus and carried it to Joseph's new tomb outside of Jerusalem there where no one was in it, because this is what they would do, is they'd put a body in the tomb. They would occasionally maybe come back and put more spices on it to cover the stench. And then when the flesh completely decayed, they would gather up the bones and put them in a stone box called an ossuary. And so there were women watching this. They were watching, some of the women disciples were watching them carry the body to the tomb. And they noted the tomb, which one it was. And after Joseph and Nicodemus roll a stone in front of it, they probably had help again because the stone would have been really large. The women noted where this was. They went back home and began to prepare more spices and ointments to anoint the body of Jesus. And they were going to wait until the next day passed because it was the Sabbath and come back on the third day from Friday to Saturday to Sunday and further anoint the body. But they just won't let up. And once again, the chief priests, partnering with the Pharisees, go to Pilate. And they said that this deceiver said, on the third day I will rise. It's like Jesus kept haunting them. He's dead and in the tomb. And they asked Pilate for a guard to be put at the tomb. Pilate conceded. He doesn't want more mess. And they seal the rock around the tomb, sealing it so people would know if it had been disturbed. And they place guards there, Roman soldiers there. And they waited. Jesus really died. There were so many things, so many facts about the case that clearly indicate, that clearly they declare and shout that he was dead. But this is a death like no other death. Listen, the Romans had crucified thousands of people. 100 years before Jesus, Spartacus and some other slave gladiators had escaped and started a revolution. And it took a long time for the Romans to put it down. And finally, when they did, they crucified 6,000 of these runaway slaves on the road leading into Rome. 6,000 of them. But those were sinners, like all humans who have died, even who have died at the hand of an executioner or died some kind of brutal death. They're all sinners. But the Lamb of God was pure and spotless. And what Peter says about Him, working from the prophecy of Isaiah, is that He, Jesus, Himself bore our sins in His body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. It's not just that He died and how that He died, but it's why. He died to save you. He experienced every bit of this to save you and to save me. His birth was beautiful and fascinating and exciting. His miracles were astounding. And all those things did was to provide evidence that He was the Messiah. But His birth and His miracles cannot save you. And it's nothing but a distraction when people are fascinated by those things. And they miss the thing that can save us. It's His death. And only His death. And only the death of this Lamb of God that can save us. And so what looked to the human eye, to both enemy and disciple, as to be merely this humiliated man, this conquered man, this dead man, that was only part of the picture. He was humiliated and conquered and dead. But there was way more. What really was going on is that God was sacrificing His Lamb, and according to His determined plan, there was strength in this weakness. There was victory in this defeat. There was glory in this suffering. There was life in this death. And on the third day, this will be clearly seen. We'll look at that next week, Lord willing. Right now, Zachary's going to come and lead us in a song, because Jesus commanded us to remember all of this by eating the bread and drinking the cup. And after Zachary leads us in this song, that's what we'll do. Zachary's going to lead us in another song as an invitation song. What else could God do? What more would you want Him to do? What else must He say to convince you to turn to Him? Jesus said both in John 3 and in John 12, He spoke of being lifted up to draw people to Himself. Did you see the crucified Jesus? And will you come to Him? Have you yet to be saved by His blood? Have you yet to be reconciled to God through His death? It can happen any time, day or night. But after seeing Jesus, will you not come to Him? Today you can confess your faith and be baptized into His death and be reconciled to God by His blood. If you want that, we encourage you to let us know by coming forward as we stand and sing.